Hold on. Test, test. Okay, so let's get started. We have a few different topics before we actually come to the topic that's slated on the syllabus for today. We have a little bit left from frequency domain EEG coverage, and then we'll go on to talk about event-related brain potentials. You'll need the handout from two times ago. It's the one that says we have umpteen slides from the last handout, and then this handout. I have three of them. Anybody need one? Okay. Here's one. Who else? Okay. There's one more. Okay. There you go. Okay. If you go to the webpage where we have the podcast and the color slides, each set does start again. So there's overlap there because those are just electrons, but I didn't, you know, keep reprinting slides to waste paper. So. Okay, so by way of announcement, too many things have come at me too quickly, so I'll have your prospectus feedback and approval, you know, by tomorrow. I was out of town, so I apologize for that. And today we'll have 3x5 × 2, which I guess is 6x10, because we'll have stuff from the sleep and also then things from the last time. So let's start with sleep, and then we'll go backwards in time to talk about the questions you had about EEG, and that'll lead us into the lecture today. From the sleep lecture, some of the questions Dick answered, so I'm going to pretend that I'm Dick, and some of the questions Leisha will answer, and she won't have to pretend that she's Leisha. So the first question is, I think, a pragmatic one. How long can humans go without sleep before incurring life-threatening health effects, said the grad student. Okay. Well, Dick says rats die in about 3 weeks if they don't get any sleep, so I guess you can feel good that you're not a rat. The records for humans to go without sleep are a minimum of 11 days, and there are some claims about the 16 days, but the question is probably really directed at partial sleep deprivation rather than total, because nobody really stays awake incessantly for that long, because in rats what they do is they keep waking them up anytime they go to sleep. They're on a little treadmill or a little disc over some water, and rats don't like water. Every time they fall asleep, the disc starts to spin. So they would fall into the water, so they have to wake up. So they're fully deprived, whereas humans are probably only partially deprived, sleeping in the car and in lecture and things like that. But there's a buildup of negative consequences for even partial sleep deprivation. There's no absolute safe number, as there are strong individual differences. Beware. Why did the elderly have fragmented sleep? Dick says several times no one really knows for sure. There's evidence that the elderly are more aroused and have lighter sleep than younger adults, and so they're more easily awakened. And it's also thought they have less sleep pressure, that is, the push to fall to sleep. But we really don't know the answer for sure. Okay. Is it possible to make a person less sleepy when staying up for a long time by manipulating body temperature? Because you saw the slides that he showed how core body temperature followed a circadian cycle, and it would follow the sleep-wake cycle. So he says, probably yes to a limited degree, pun intended, raise their temperature to a limited degree. It's not my pun. By manipulating arousal, we'd also change temperature. Increasing ambient temperature has some, but not a great effect on arousal. Okay. So it's probably not going to be a new cure. Okay. Bless you. Do you feel more or less rested if you have experienced a lot of REM sleep? I always thought that REM sleep was recuperative and relaxing sleep. However, we were told it can be stressful with increased heartbeat and breathing. And Dick says, REM sleep is not physiologically restorative, slow-wave sleep is. For example, alcoholics who go into withdrawal have a lot of REM sleep, often associated with nightmares. And then he goes on to state, this isn't relaxing sleep. Okay. So, I think maybe what the question asker was referring to, though, is that REM sleep does seem to have some emotionally restorative effects, and if people are selectively deprived of REM sleep, they don't cope particularly well with emotional stressors. But REM sleep, per se, is not necessarily relaxing. Is there any significant difference in the quality of sleep or wakefulness between people who go to bed early and wake up early and those who stay up late and sleep in? And Dick says that Leisha says,
So there's not really, people kind of sleep according to their own rhythms, and as long as you're getting good sleep, it doesn't matter when you do it. But that being said, late sleepers tend to have more other problems and like medical and psychiatric complications, but that also could be a result of people who choose to be late sleepers, and so it's like it's correlational, it's not causal.
Okay. And I add to that, Brandt has some correlational data in a set that we're looking at that people who are shifted more towards late to bed and late to rise also have higher levels of depressive symptoms. Okay. It's another one for you, Alicia. How does stress affect sleep patterns? Seems like depression can either produce an individual an affinity for sleeping more or perhaps less than normal. Does it work the same way with stress or anxiety?
So the relationship here with sleep and depression is pretty well studied, and I'm assuming that whoever asked, referring to the symptoms, like the symptom of depression can either be sleeping a lot or sleeping a little. And there's also these things like the REM sleep abnormalities that Dick was talking about that are kind of present in people with depression. And the relationship between stress or anxiety disorders and sleep isn't as well studied. There are sleep disturbances in stress and anxiety, but it's probably likely due to like the rumination that people are experiencing as they're trying to go to bed and they're anxious and they're thinking about stuff, and it can make sleep more disruptive, but it doesn't have the same kind of like psychological correlates that depression does.
Okay. And I think this is your last one. How do we know that dreaming happens during REM? Alicia said that we remember more of our dreams in the morning because our REMs were longer, implying dreams happen during REM. Can't dreams happen in other stages? If so, doesn't that invalidate the statement or assertion that we should remember more dreams in the morning than in the middle of the night?
So, this. We know that dreams happen during REM because of lots of studies that have been done waking up people in the middle of REM and asking them to report their dreams, and they're much more likely, initial study shows they were much more likely to recall them in REM than any other stage, but as we've read in the textbook, it kind of depends on how you define a dream. So you can dream in any stage of sleep, but the REM dreams are the ones where like you wake up and you're more likely to say, like, I was in the grocery store and like my cousin was there, which was weird. My cousin was in New York, but he shouldn't have been there, but then all of a sudden we were in the market, in the Marketplace Mall, and blah, 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 and I don't know, like a consistent storyline that may not make sense, but it's a sequence of events and vivid imagery. Non-REM dreams tend to be more like vague images and like senses like fear or anxiety rather than like a consistent story. The exception to that is sleep onset imagery, which can have vivid imagery, but that's also specific to sleep onset, so beginning of the night. And I don't think someone would qualify. If you woke someone up, I don't know if they'd say they were dreaming or what, but yeah, so I don't know if that's So we should remember more vivid, detailed, story-like dreams in the morning because those are the ones that happen in REM, and REM gets longer as you move to the morning.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Okay, so now we'll go back, and you probably don't even remember the 3x5 questions you had from a couple of lectures ago, but there were a few there were lots of good questions and a few that we'll talk about here. So, under the framework for understanding whether EEG asymmetry can be an indicator, what do you mean by liability? So I'll take you back to this big table that wasn't obviously going to be readable on your handout. It is in the online version if you want, but it was a framework for thinking about if you have a psychophysiological indicator that differentiates one group from another, in this case depressed from non-depressed, what does that mean? What is it signifying? And there can be episode markers that are going to come and go with the episode. Okay. Now, the most obvious episode marker is people self-report. They feel depressed, down, sad, hopeless, blue, and so on. Sleep disturbance might also be an episode marker, for example. Okay. But a liability marker is going to endure beyond the episode, and it might identify the kind of person who is liable or predisposed or at risk. So that's what we mean by liability marker. And so you see in this column here are just some criteria that we look at for a liability indicator that, it characterizes depressed people. It doesn't characterize people without any history of depression, and it differentiates them regardless of whether they're in episode. It endures beyond the episode. And ideally, it's going to predict future development of depression in people who are not currently depressed, even in people who have never been depressed, if we could do such a study, although that would be a hard study to do. You'd have to assess large numbers of people and wait for first onset. Okay. And then a genetic marker is going to be a special case of liability indicator, because a liability indicator could stem from early life experience, some kind of accident, or genetic causes. Okay. Another question from the last time is, given that greater right EEG activity is correlated with depression and greater left EEG activity is correlated with anger, what happens when depressed people get mad? So, good question. Did the head blow up? I think there are at least two possibilities here to consider. And one of them is that, depending on the nature of that anger, they could respond just like everybody else. But they still might differ from controls. So if this is our metric here of increased left activity and decreased left activity here, then you would expect depressed people at rest to be here and non-depressed people to be here. They have relatively more left frontal activity. Now, when people get angry, there's a shift to the left. Greater left frontal activity. So one possibility is both groups go up. Okay. So there's a state effect superimposed upon the trait effect. Okay. This prediction presumes that anger functions the same way in depressed and non-depressed people. Right. It's an approach-related, engagement-related emotion that propels them to, you know, engage with the people in their environment. Certainly, clinically, you can describe people with depression who don't respond that way. When they get angry, they withdraw, they feel bad, they feel hopeless. One of the best examples of this, we're running a big treatment study. A woman came into the study late, and she was just in tears because somebody had flipped her off when she was driving and called her a bad driver. Now, most people's response isn't one of submission, withdrawal, and feeling bad about themselves in that circumstance. But it shows how that anger may function quite differently. So, another possibility is, at least among some people with depression, they won't experience their anger as an engaging force, but instead something to withdraw, in which case, then we might expect that effect if it functions as a withdrawal-related emotion for them. So that's an interesting idea. I'm not aware of any work done specifically in that paradigm. So I understand there are individual differences in skull thickness, but are those differences uniform across the skull? So we talked about a lot of the amplitude difference you see in EEG could be accounted for by things that we're really not very interested in, like skull thickness. I don't think that they're vastly different across the skull as a function of persons. In other words, different parts of the skull are thicker than others, but I don't think that pattern differs a lot across people. But to be really safe, you'd want to do some kind of anatomical scan, and you could actually quantify that. So at the moment, we don't have a really good answer to that question. In the Cohn, Allen, and Harmon Jones study, this was the one where people posed facial expressions of anger and fear and sadness and happiness and so on. You use different references for the alpha asymmetry measures. Why was this done again? What's the principle on which references are selected for experiments? Well, it's done because we really don't know what the optimum reference is in this literature. So these were the findings to which the question refers. So each one of these panels reflects a different reference, the reference being the average of all active electrodes, CZ at the vertex, and linked mastoid, which is really an average mastoid. They're not physically linked, but they're averaged offline. You can see the general pattern is fairly similar across them, although CZ usually looks like the outlier here. Linked mastoid looks like the outlier a little bit. But the pattern is still generally the same across them. Now, many studies, if you look in this literature, will use just one reference scheme. And sometimes things don't replicate across reference schemes. So we wanted to make it explicit and put them all in there so people could, you know, take a look and see. Now, more generally, in terms of the principle, if you're thinking about, you know, you're recording something at, let's say, F3 or F4, you're always recording it at F3 or F4 relative to some other location. That's your reference. And so what you choose for your reference will determine in part what you're going to see. Okay? So if you choose a site that might be, like this is F3 here, you choose CZ, it's pretty close by. You're not going to see a lot of activity difference between them. On the other hand, CZ is a very active reference. And if you're trying to pick up something like alpha power, a lot of alpha power may be driven by CZ rather than by the site that you're interested in. The ideal would be to find the least active reference as possible and one that's on the other side of the generators you think are important. So if you think, you know, this region of frontal cortex is important, you'd want an inactive reference that's fairly low, like the average mastoids, for example. Okay. So another one, after we kept talking about left and right and relative left and relative right and shifting and increasing and decreasing, a reasonable question at the end of this is, so I just wanted to make sure this is correct. When there's greater left frontal lobe alpha activity, this means there's an increase in approach-related behavior? No. There are several things to say here. So first of all, there is a relatively left frontal alpha, which means there is greater left frontal activity. So the first thing here is that when we see more alpha, we infer there to be less activity. So if we would just scratch alpha off of there, then we could say when we presume there to be greater left frontal lobe activity, this means there's an increase in approach-related behavior, almost. And this is just a point that, you know, is not unique to psychophysiology, but when we talk about individual differences on the one hand and changes on the other, we shouldn't mix those. So if there's greater left frontal activity in one person than another, that person may have more approach-related behavior. Or if we see increases in left frontal lobe activity, that may correlate with increases in approach-related behavior. But there's really two things. The greater would refer to differences between people. Increases would refer to changes within a person. Okay. And the final 3x5 was, I asked you what you thought of the 3x5s, and I think that they're a hit. Based on the feedback I got feedback like, I like 3x5 time. I like 3x5 time, good review of the last lecture and answers a lot of questions I've had. 3x5s are uber cool. Okay. The 3x5 cards are the most wonderful teaching ideas I've heard of. So, okay. And then we had a cynic who said, they're adequate. I say keep it. But this was the most negative I had, so I'm assuming these are a good idea, so it's a good way to get us oriented again. Okay. And the last one, can you define or discuss synchronization and desynchronization once more? I couldn't ask for a better segue into where we'll start talking today. So, we left off last time with this idea of synchronization and desynchronization, and on the end of a lecture, I know it's always hard to get new concepts. We'll start up here again. So, the reason the terms are called synchronization and desynchronization is the idea that when alpha was present, and remember, alpha was all that people usually could see before they had computers and FFTs. When you were looking at polygraph charts with pens racing up and down, alpha, delta, theta, these large, slow components, reflected synchronized activity. And so when that activity was blocked, like when alpha was blocked, the supposition was that then things had become desynchronized. You don't have as many neuronal ensembles anymore acting in concert with one another. Now, that view is, you know, technically not correct, because any activity you see has to represent some degree of synchronization. Otherwise, you wouldn't see oscillatory activity. It's just that when you see higher frequency activity, like gamma band activity, 30 to 50 hertz activity, you have smaller populations that are synchronized with each other, as opposed to these large populations that might underlie alpha or even delta. Okay, so it's still highly synchronized, it's just not at that band anymore. And maybe fewer neuronal ensembles. So here's an example that we can see of event-related synchronization, meaning more alpha, and desynchronization, meaning less alpha. And there's two tasks that subjects are performing. In the top plot, they are reading, or they start reading something that comes on the screen, and in the bottom plot, they just make a voluntary movement with their right hand. So what you see when they're reading here, they're not making a motor movement, so over the motor cortex C4, for example, which would be important in a motor movement, there's actually an increase in alpha over regions of cortex that wouldn't be important for the activity, whereas there's an alpha blocking over occipital cortex, which we presume would be involved in reading the visual stimulus. Okay? So it's event-related desynchronization, a decrease in alpha, when that we have the electrode over the cortex that we think is actively processing the stimulus. Now, in the other case, there's a voluntary movement here of the hand, and you can see there's an event-related desynchronization or alpha blocking over the somatosensory cortex, as we'd expect. And since they're not reading, you can see there's actually an alpha enhancement over the occipital cortex. So we have event-related synchronization there. Here's another example. In this case, the person's making a movement with the right hand here at this point. And what you can see is, you know, here we're going to be interested, of course, in somatosensory electrodes again. Since it's a right hand movement, we're going to be primarily interested in left somatosensory cortex, or C3. And you can see there's alpha activity extending along here, and then it's blocked right here. So starting here is the event-related desynchronization. You can see at C4 the same thing happens, but just a little bit later. And there's extensive interconnections between the left and right somatosensory cortices, which makes sense if you need to, you know, coordinate the activity of the left and the right side. And then that's all prior to and preparing for the movement. So you can see, you know, even before the movement actually happens, there's event-related desynchronization. And then here at electrodes over regions that are not going to be particularly involved in making the movement, parietal and occipital regions, you can see event-related synchronization, or ERS, there. Okay, so that's what we covered last time, and I left you with this idea, and this picture here comes from a study by Ahern et al. Looking at patients when they were undergoing pharmacological inactivation of one or the other hemisphere. It's called the WADA test. They do that to localize language function in people who are being considered for surgery to remove an epileptic focus. Now, people in this study had both left and right foci, and so they also, and in any person, they inactivate one and then later the other hemisphere. But all of these data have been flipped so that they look like they would be a left hemisphere inactivation. So you see all the white, which are going to be the brighter colors, are going to mean increase in activity. So at baseline, everything is zeroed out. And then here you can see in the first epoch, and each epoch I think was about a few minutes, you can see that there's a massive increase in delta over the anesthetized hemisphere, as you probably would expect. Theta, yes. Alpha, yes. Also even beta, you can see. There's basically an increase in everything. And you might have expected a priori going into this that there'd at least be some decrease in activity in these beta bands. So there's an increased synchronization of everything, all these different bands, when the hemisphere should be not actively processing information because it's been pharmacologically inactivated. And you can see, you know, that persists for several minutes of time, and eventually, you know, each band has its different recovery function here. Okay. So, you know, it leaves us with the question, well, if everything synchronizes, something has to desynchronize, something has to get less active. And this was an older study. It was done in 1990, I think. And they didn't have a high sampling rate, and so if they don't have a high sampling rate, the Nyquist frequency is low, which means we can't look at the higher frequency activity in the gamma band. So it would be very interesting to see if this were done again, if you actually see not an increase in gamma, like everything else, but a decrease in gamma. So you see all of the slower frequencies up to about beta 2, which goes to about 20 hertz, all those may go up when there's less activity in the brain, but then the higher frequency activity should go down. So that's obviously a pretty drastic manipulation. So there are obviously other kinds of manipulations you can do to look at synchronized activity. So I'll talk briefly about the study that was on the reading list, and it was looking at midline frontal theta. And so theta, as I mentioned early on, is the kind of activity that can be indicative of focused active processing, but it can also be indicative of kind of diffuse global inactivity. And it really depends under what kinds of circumstances you observe it and how focally you observe it. So under tasks that require attention, memory, error monitoring, a demand for potentially recruiting additional resources to the task, there's a prominent midline frontal theta. And you see it on the scalp right along the midline probably at sites FC, FCZ, and CZ. Okay. Whereas in pathological conditions, people who might have had stroke, dementing illness, or even ADHD, you can see a diffuse increase in theta, but it's not this frontal midline theta. Okay. So it's this frontal midline theta then that was of interest in this study. And we'll talk about this again when we talk about error monitoring and some things in the advanced topics. Okay. So this was the study by Wolfgang Klemesch and colleagues. And they had a task where they had people conducting finger movements. They were either simple finger movements, that is, they would be things that would come in order, so it wasn't very difficult to do. People could do it easily and memorize it easily. Or they had simple or complex finger movements where they weren't necessarily in order and they'd have to do them, you know, as numbers would come up. And so they varied the difficulty. Was it easy or was it difficult? And they also varied the memory load. Sometimes they did it just watching a number go on the screen and they would do the finger movement. Other times they had to do it from memory. And they look at task-related theta power in the 4 to 7 hertz band for each condition relative to a 5-minute resting baseline. Now, one comment about baseline, again, we assume people are doing nothing, or at least doing nothing with the cortex that we're interested in, and of course they are. But it will represent, hopefully, task-related activity here that wasn't seen during the baseline. In addition, they measured phase coherence, a degree of synchronization of activity across sites. For now, you can think of this roughly as a correlation value ranging from 0, meaning sites are operating independently of each other, to 1, meaning sites are entirely locked with each other. And this value is expressed frequency by frequency. We'll talk more about how this is computed in the advanced topics as well. And this will just be expressed as percent increase over rest. So we can see if different sites become engaged and they reflect activity that's coordinated, then we should see that they become phase locked, and that that's much higher than it is at baseline. So obviously sites that are adjacent to each other will show some phase coupling just naturally. Okay. So here's the theta power that they see. So these are memorized, I guess British memorized words, and just our sequences, and then novel sequences where they have to do it on the fly. And then they are both simple and complex. This is just a scale, like, you know, 4, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, if you're playing piano. And what you see is only one condition that differs. It has a lot more theta power, and it clearly does have a frontal midline focus, but it's also fairly broadly distributed across the entire top of the head. And that's the condition where they have to do a complex sequence that they haven't seen before. So it's going to require a lot of attentional demand, and they're going to have to pay attention as they're learning. Now, they also look then at the phase synchronization, and these look like the things that five-year-olds draw. But these are lines showing sites that have significant increases in their coupling or significant increases in their phase coherence. And so there are some dotted lines in here that show a significant decrease from baseline, but there aren't very many of those. And it turns out that the novel conditions show higher phase synchrony across these different sites, which was contrary to predictions. They had predicted it would be the memory load that drove this effect. Okay. What they're speculating is there needs to be an integration across multiple cortical regions of the visual input with the sensory motor information. And so this is going to be a demanding task and require a lot of synchronous connections or synchronous activity across disparate brain regions. And that's why you see this degree of synchrony. Okay. But in looking at this and going back to what I said at the beginning, you know, theta does not equal theta does not equal theta, in that, you know, you might expect a predominance, if it's frontal midline theta, that this would be like, you know, O'Hare International with everything going out and in from it. But you see things kind of all over the scalp. So I'm not quite as convinced about the interpretation of this as they are. Okay. So, but that was in the theta band. So the last bit that I'll talk about with respect to frequency domain activity is gamma band activity, or what was first known often as 40 hertz activity. And I'll put 40 in quotes because it's 40 plus or minus some amount, but it's activity that's fairly high frequency. It's above the beta band activity. Now, the first reports of important 40 hertz activity came from Daniel Scheer and his colleague Grandstaff. And in their review, they found this pronounced rhythmic electrical bursting in the 40 hertz band. And he was originally looking at visual perception in anesthetized cats. And so he was actually doing indwelling recording, where he recorded this 40 hertz activity in local field potentials in the occipital cortex. But he really kind of pushed this idea that higher frequency activity could be of interest. And it came at a time when, you know, the predominant measures were things like alpha, because they were easily visualized, they were easily quantified with the equipment of the era. Okay. So his work with cats, he had several studies, but this will just show you kind of a typical study. It was a learning paradigm where they had to discriminate between two different frequencies of light flicker. So they had to learn to press a lever to a discriminative stimulus, which was a 7 cycle per second light flicker. So 7 times a second the light would flicker. And if they did that, they were rewarded. But they had to learn not to press to an S minus, and that would be a 3 cycle per second light flicker, and they wouldn't be rewarded for pressing to that. And his hypothesis is that synchronized 40 hertz activity would represent the focus activation of those cortical areas necessary for the performance of the task. So in this case, visual cortex, in order to discriminate between the two stimuli. So these show the results in 3 different regions of cortex: visual cortex, which is the one where the hypothesis is made; motor cortex, which we wouldn't expect anything, or at least if we did, it wouldn't be around the time of the stimulus discrimination; and auditory cortex, where we'd expect no event-related changes. Looking at this, this is time, with R being the time of the response that the animal makes. This direction, the depth direction, we're looking at frequency of activity, 20, 25, 30, 40, and 50 hertz. So 40 hertz activity is going to be this band right through here. And then the vertical direction is the percent power increase. So what we see is that there's a large power increase in the 40 hertz band right here, right preceding and following the response. So there's this increase in 40 hertz activity. And this, by the way, is only to the discriminative stimulus, the 7 cycles per second stimulus. Okay? There's some little hint of synchronized 40 hertz activity a little bit later here for the response in the motor cortex, but the primary area here that we see is the visual cortex. Now, compare that in the next slide here with the S minus. So this is not the stimulus that's going to be getting a reward. You can see that there's really no increase in 40 hertz activity. There's an increase in slower frequency activity, but not in the 40 hertz activity to the S minus. Okay. So this was some of the early work, but obviously it didn't really say too much about how these concepts were perceived to the organism. And so he went on to do some work with humans. And the hypothesis that he had was that 40 hertz activity would correlate with a focused state of arousal or cortical activation. So it's active cortical processing. You'd expect to see it when there's event-related desynchronization in those other lower bands. Now, some evidence in support of that. An interesting study by Bird and colleagues in 1978 used a biofeedback paradigm, and they trained people to increase their 40 hertz activity through a simple biofeedback training paradigm. And as people increased 40 hertz activity, they reported high arousal and strong mental concentration. Evidence a little more, I think, compelling than that. I mean, that's interesting, but not definitive. This evidence I like a little more. Marty Ford and his colleagues trained people to voluntarily suppress 40 hertz activity. So it's, again, a training paradigm. So now they're suppressing 40 hertz activity. And then when they give them problems to solve, they can't keep the activity suppressed. So when they need to actively engage in problem solving, there's a reemergence of 40 hertz. Even though they've been trained to suppress it, they can't do that when they're actively problem solving. Okay. So he at least concludes that 40 hertz activity and active problem solving in that paradigm are incompatible.
Mm-hmm. So they also train people to voluntarily suppress some other frequency and see if those people are also
able to. I don't remember. I'd have to go back and check. That would be an important control, right? Because it may just be that doing the two tasks at once is really hard to do. Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question.
Mm-hmm. What were you saying about 40 hertz activity in specific populations like ADHD?
Oh, I wasn't saying anything about 40 hertz activity in ADHD. I was talking about theta activity, that diffuse increased theta characterizes many different populations where we think there may be some degree of brain dysfunction or pathology. Okay. But this focused increased midline frontal theta is not seen as pathological. But now we're shifting gears from theta, which is 4 to 7, to 40 hertz, plus or minus a bit.
Did they ever do anything with 40 hertz and disorders where there's less arousal?
40 hertz and what kinds of disorders?
Just disorders where they're known to not have arousal.
Scheer had a study with Alzheimer's, saw that they couldn't get task-dependent activation in the 40 hertz band, for example.
So it does.
Mm-hmm. Little, but it's scant.
And the schizophrenia.
Yeah?
With Brett Clements. Mm-hmm. Actually, my honor students was on it. We found less 40 hertz in schizophrenia patients and their first degree relatives.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, okay. So I don't know if...
And was that task activated 40 hertz activity?
Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay. So. Nice. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I just wanted to see if it was possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess all else being equal, you want to be able to show 40 hertz activity when a task demands it. Okay. This is all correlative, but it seems to correlate with good outcomes, and absence correlates with bad outcomes. Okay. Now, another piece of evidence that suggests some specificity here is that there are lateralized task effects, so tasks might depend more on left or right processing. So, Loring and Scheer, in 84, took a look at right-handed students and had them conduct two tasks. One was an analogies task, like in what way are an apple and a banana alike? Or no, that's not analogies. No. An apple is to fruit as Camaro is to car, right? So, okay, all right. And a spatial task where they had to localize a feature in space. So we would presume that this should engage greater left than right hemisphere activity, and this should engage greater right than left hemisphere activity, and that should show up in the same pattern of 40 hertz activity, greater left for the analogies task and greater right for the spatial task. So they computed laterality ratios. They just took left minus right over left plus right, 40 hertz. So since we're taking left minus the right, a higher number would equal more left hemisphere 40 hertz activity. And since it's 40 hertz, we actually think of that as activity. So a higher number should equal greater left hemisphere activity. And he did this over a parietal occipital temporal triangle on each side that were homologous. So you've got T3, O1, and T5. So it's right there at the parietal occipital temporal region. So it's a fairly broad region that they're looking at. So, in terms of the results, first of all, one thing I think is really quite interesting wasn't built into the study, but baseline effects are most variable. So, what we see, the clear bars here, are those laterality ratios at baseline. So you see, they're kind of all over the map, from quite a bit of relative left activity to quite a bit of relative right activity, which just makes the point once again that a baseline isn't doing nothing, but people are doing things, and they may be doing things in systematic ways. But then the variance goes down in the tasks and the means shift, so that verbal laterality ratios shift to the left and spatial laterality ratios shift to the right. So suggesting greater left activity for the verbal tasks and greater right activity for the spatial tasks. So it's a greater variability at baseline, smallest variability, and the greatest activation of the left hemisphere during the verbal task. And they also looked at 40 hertz EMG bands. I'll say a little more about how they did that. But this didn't seem to be an EMG effect. It seems to be an EEG effect. Because that's one of the important concerns in doing this work. Remember, EMG has a broad frequency spectrum. And it may not really worry us too much down in the alpha or certainly the theta band. But it might worry us quite a bit up in the 40 hertz band. Okay. All right, so they tried to control specifically for these EMG contributions, and Spidell and Scheer in 82 used these similar tasks and found similar results. And they used very conservative controls for muscle artifact. So in this study, again, they had a verbal task and a mental rotation task, and this is that same, now we're not doing a ratio, we're actually looking at changes from baseline, so a positive number here indicates more 40 hertz activity in the left region during the verbal task, not much change on the right, and during the mental rotation task, significantly greater increase on the right than on the left. And that's the total EEG, and they separate out from that a component of the EEG that they're sure is EEG and might not be EMG. So in other words, this could reflect some EMG. This, they think, is devoid of EMG, and I'll show you how they do that, or how they think they do that in a moment. And you see the effects are the same and even stronger once you try to account for the EMG activity.
Mm-hmm. Why would 1.2 bigger than 1, why would that number be larger if that one's just the 40 hertz EEG? Why wouldn't, under total, why wouldn't it be more?
Because it's a change score, and so this is going to be changed from 40 hertz baseline.
Okay,
so
sorry,
this
yeah.
is the total 40 hertz activity recorded at those electrodes minus the baseline, and this is going to be the 40 hertz EEG activity devoid of the EMG contributions compared to the baseline that's also devoid of the EMG contributions. That's, yeah, that's good. That's not immediately obvious. Okay, so the important thing here is, you know, you see opposite patterns for the two tasks, and those patterns get stronger once you even try to take out the EMG effect. So further arguing it's not an EMG effect. And you look down here, this is just showing the correlations between the 40 hertz total and the 40 hertz EEG, and those are uniformly strong and positive. And the 40 hertz EMG, which I'll still be showing you in a moment now that I'm building it up with such great anticipation, it doesn't correlate very highly with the total. It's not a significant contributor here. Okay. So here's how they did it. So the subject is hooked up to the EEG, and there are a couple of amplifiers. One amplifier just gets alpha, and you can tell this was done back probably in the late 70s or around 1980. They weren't doing all of this offline. They were doing it using online devices. So they had an online filtering device of alpha, and then they, like EMG, they rectified and integrated it so you can just get a power estimate in that band. They had an alpha counter. This other amplifier, they had beta, 40 hertz, and 70 hertz activity, and they count their beta and they count their 40 hertz. They also recorded EMG electrodes from bipolar placements over EMG locations, like temporalis, I believe, and they break that into 70 and 40 hertz as well. Assuming that the 70 hertz activity should not be EEG in origin, but it should be EMG in origin, then if there are spikes of EMG activity and EEG activity that are coincident, and the coincident detection unit detects it, then it's going to exclude from consideration any 40 hertz activity during that time. But if there's not coincident activity in the 70 hertz band in the EMG channel and the EEG channel, then it will assume that whatever 40 hertz activity is happening will be 40 hertz EEG. Okay? So this just happens online, and if that 40 hertz activity happens to happen at the same time that 70 hertz EEG and some EMG have the same pattern of spiking, it won't be counted. Okay? It's probably a little bit more conservative than you'd need. We still don't know that this 40 hertz activity isn't coming from the brain, but if it comes coincident with EMG, they're getting rid of it. So looking at this, you can see why not a lot of people adopted the procedure. It's fairly complicated. Not a lot of people could build these kinds of devices. So the work was done primarily by this small group for some period of time. Now using these controls, they also took a look at Alzheimer's patients, and non-Alzheimer's patients showed task-related changes with appropriate lateralization like those that we've seen, but the Alzheimer's patients did not. And just to throw in one study that we did shortly after I got here, David Schneier took a look at some data of very highly hypnotizable people. And one of the ideas behind highly hypnotizable people is that they can bring to bear highly focused attention in order to exclude irrelevant stimuli from whatever it is they're focusing on and really focus in on the stimulus of interest. And that's been levied as an explanation, primarily armchair theoretical explanation, for how it is that they can not perceive things that are in their environment or perceive things in front of them that might not be there. So we just took a look at four levels of hypnotizability. The important thing for this point is that this group over here is the most highly hypnotizable group, representing about 1% of the population. These people are highly hypnotizable, and they will fail to recognize items that transpired during hypnosis that they've been suggested to forget. And what you can see is that site FZ here, site PZ here, and site PT6 over here, PZ here, that at these sites, there's an increase in 40 hertz activity in just that group. It's specific to that group that's most highly hypnotizable. Okay. We don't have EMG controls in this study like those in Shear, but this is at rest. Okay. And this is eyes open over here, eyes closed. Doesn't really seem to matter. Okay. So, I mean, this is all pretty exciting stuff, and you might wonder, well, why hasn't this really exploded? Well, the EMG concern, I think, is a very real one. And if you don't have those kinds of controls, you know, you can't rule out that what you're seeing is an increase in EMG activity. And if we think 40 hertz EEG is increased arousal, increased attention, might that not also be the same circumstances under which you might have increased muscle tension? So it's a very real concern. But it may be overrated, remembering that table that showed the correlation. The EMG activity didn't correlate particularly highly with the total EEG. Another downer for the research is that Shear died. And that is a great way to kill a research program. But all is not lost. There's a lot of renewed interest in this. And a lot of the more powerful signal processing techniques that we'll talk about in the advanced lectures have ways of trying to, you know, look at real-time dynamics of gamma band activity. So we'll, I think that is making a comeback. Question? Okay. Okay. Now, as an example of a comeback, here's a paper in Science that took a look at 40 hertz local field at potential. So these are recorded intracranially, but not intracellularly. And looking at the frequency of activity correlating with the bold signal and correlating with actual numbers of spikes. And so what you can see here is that there's a robust positive correlation starting right around 40 hertz and on through. So the nice thing about this study is there won't be an EMG artifact in local field potentials because there's not muscle inside the head. So this is just the frequency of oscillatory activity in those populations and the bold signal from those voxels, or in other cases the number of spiking happening. So it does seem that this higher frequency activity reflects brain activity measured either by metabolism or by actual neuronal activity. You see these other frequencies where we saw they all increased when the brain was less active, they actually show a negative correlation with brain activity. Now, there's been a revitalized interest in this field, and one person that's been particularly, I think, responsible for it is Wolf Singer. And by the way, he's coming to Tucson. He's talking this Thursday at the Consciousness Conference. So if you're interested, you might see if you can get a one-day entrance to that. It's this Thursday at 11:10 a.m.
It's free for students.
It's free for students. Okay. So to understand where Singer's deriving his thesis, we'll talk about something known as the binding problem. The binding problem refers to this problem where we bind together lots of physical percepts in our environment, and we don't perceive them as disparate physical percepts, but they all bind together as a unified object. So we don't see, you know, somebody with blonde hair as the hair and the blonde. It is blonde hair. And when somebody's talking to us, we don't see somebody and then there's somebody talking. I mean, it's unified. It has a perceptual unity to it. And any, you know, given set of cells is going to code for a limited set of features, so they have to be integrated. But the number of things that have to be integrated is enormous. And so this is the so-called binding problem. How can they be integrated? You know, what you could imagine devising some kind of Rube Goldberg brain where they all converge on some cell. And then that cell knows that they're all somehow active. But that wouldn't be a very efficient solution because then you have to have a cell for every possible conjunction of features. So that would pose quite a problem. Okay. So there's, you know, if there were a cell for a unique contribution of attributes and convergent information would converge on those, but there's a finite number of cells and an infinite number of representations that we could potentially have. So that's problematic. So, you know, he would argue that we can't possibly handle, even with our billions and billions of brain cells, all the possible permutations of representations that need to be bound together. So the perspective he talks about is a functional one, that the binding happens not physically but functionally through synchronized oscillatory activity of the relevant sensory or cognitive regions. So there's no single site of integration, but but it's a simultaneous activation of these different assemblies of neurons across wide cortical areas. So if the visual representation happens at the same time as the sound, and it seems to be coming from the same location in space, then that may be bound together by functional activation. And so neurons in any assembly could adaptively tune in and tune out to different assemblies depending on what's going on in the environment at the time. And that would account for, you know, how you can see the same scene, hear the same scene, be in the same scene, and sometimes perceive one aspect of it, maybe some noise coming from the corner, versus another time you perceive some other aspect of it, perhaps the lecturer, for example. And so this would happen through a temporal coding or through synchronous activation, something like 40 Hertz activation, for example. And so it allows that a single neuron could even be part of two assemblies, but they would be oscillating slightly differently, slightly different frequencies or out of phase with each other, but that same neuron could multitask and be part of two active assemblies. So the implication of this is that it's a very adaptive system, and there doesn't have to be any direct neuronal connections. There just has to be this simultaneous activation. And merely the fact that these things are simultaneously activated would give us the unified experience of some object or some representation. Okay? And he would state that this is, to do this, you have to have some kind of oscillatory regularity. There has to be some kind of regular oscillations in the brain in order for this synchronization to happen. But that also poses a problem. So if networks are tuned to a single frequency, it's easy to synchronize them, but it wouldn't be easy to desynchronize them. And that's a problem because, you know, an example of highly synchronized activity is epileptic seizures, for example. So probably you need to have some kind of broader band oscillator, maybe centered on 40 Hertz, or it may differ a little bit by individuals or species. It couldn't be too slow, like alpha, because this would not allow us to quickly bind together various percepts. We might be a little bit slow in, you know, getting our representation. But it can't be much faster than gamma, since the human nervous system might not allow much synchronization beyond those speeds across broad regions. So it's a dynamic view. It's one that allows an organism to adaptively respond, to make new representations, things that have never been perceived before, and can change with experience. And Singer also talks about this as underlying learning, so that if units have simultaneously and synchronously activated with other units before, they may be more likely to do so again. So it might underlie how it is that we can, you know, see things more quickly once we've seen them before. We can, you know, detect things more easily once we have some familiarity with them. So he points out, you know, we really shouldn't be looking for synchronous activation at the micro level, but rather look to, you know, much broader patterns of synchronization. And EEG, of course, is ideally suited for these kinds of investigations. So the 40 Hertz might make a comeback, and I would say, you know, 40 here is going to obviously equal 40 plus or minus some range. There's no reason we'd be tuned right at 40 per se. Okay. And so that would be gamma, and we'll talk more about gamma in some of the advanced topics in just a couple of weeks. So let's see if there are questions while I hand up the next hand up. So any questions on frequency domain approaches? Okay, so another hand up? You want more? Is anybody missing a hand up? Just okay. So we're moving on to talk about the event-related potential. So everything we've talked about so far will still apply, in that the event-related brain potential is embedded within the ongoing EEG. It's just the way we choose to analyze the data and lock the data to events of interest is going to be different here than it was when we talked about frequency domain analysis. So by way of overview, event-related brain potentials are voltage changes that are embedded in the ongoing EEG, and they're going to reflect some process in response to some particular event. Now that event can be fairly broadly construed. Most often it's some kind of stimulus that's presented by the experimenter, but it could also be some kind of a response that the subject makes. It could even be an internal event if we had some good temporal marker of that internal event. But the key thing here is we're looking at these voltage changes locked to some event. Okay. So I think the first lecture I showed you a little bit of overview of how the ERP is derived, but it's probably worth reviewing here. So if we have a compliant subject like this and we hook them up, you can see EEG activity, oscillations on the order of 50 microvolts plus or minus, over time. This is about 10 seconds of activity. And if we were to display to the subject some discrete stimulus, like here's a light bulb, it could be a word, it could be a tone, it could be a picture, we would presume that the subject would make the relevant perceptual discriminations, perhaps categorize the stimulus, and decide on a relevant response. And they would do that for each and every stimulus. So there should be some predictable brain activity that happens on each and every one of those trials that's going to elicit a known signature. But if you look here in the ongoing EEG, there's nothing that's consistently altered following each stimulus. If you looked at this chunk of data and then this chunk of data, they don't look anything like each other. And that's because the ongoing EEG activity is sizable in voltage compared to the size that you're going to pick up for event-related activity. But if we make the assumption that invariant on every trial, there's some detectable neural signature, some detectable voltage pattern, then that should be present the same each and every time. And the background activity, we would assume, would be relatively randomly distributed. And so what we'd see then is this event-related brain potential. It would average in because it's there on each and every trial. The background activity sometimes might be high voltage at a time point, sometimes it might be low voltage at a time point, and it's going to average out towards zero. So this is an example of a visual event-related potential, and now you're looking at, say, 5 microvolts peak to peak, so 1/10 of this distance up here. And you have lots and lots of trials, and if you do that, you get a nice clean waveform that looks like this. So these are voltage oscillations. They're positive in the downward direction, negative in the upward direction. It's a function of time, and we're looking at about 1 second of time. What we get interested in as ERP researchers are these various bumps and troughs that we see in the ERP, and I'll talk more about how those are labeled and what they mean in just a moment.
So they're taking that big thing and they're trying to see what's consistent in that.
So they are taking a look at that big ongoing activity and trying to imagine what's consistent in it. So if we just for a moment try the crayon version of this. So we imagine that as a stimulus comes on the screen, there is some discernible pattern that's in there, right? But it adds to whatever else is going on at the time, which happens to be really big. So if we added them together, you wouldn't see this little activity.
And that's what's going on in the general one.
So that's what's going on in the top one that you saw, right? So then again, we present it, and there's this same pattern of activity in there. But this time, I'll just draw the background activity kind of as the inverse of what it was the first time. So if we average those two trials together, the background activity would average out to pretty much nothing, and the activity that was present on each one would average in. Of course, it's not quite so clear as that, so you need many more trials. Okay. But it is an assumption that that activity is present in an invariant fashion, and that's a classic view. There's an alternative view that we'll talk about in advanced topics, but that's the idea behind this. Okay. Now, there are all kinds of different potentials. This just shows something much like I showed you before. This time, instead of it being a visual evoke potential, it's an auditory evoke potential. What you'll notice is the N100 is the first prominent peak of any size, whereas in the visual evoke potential, the P1. So in the visual evoke potential, you get the first prominent component is a positive peak, and in the auditory, the first prominent component is a negative peak. But in either auditory or visual, there are also earlier components. But in the auditory in particular, there are some brainstem auditory evoked responses that occur on a very short latency. These are milliseconds. So you can see in the first 10 milliseconds, we have 7 distinct features here. Okay? And those represent various stages of processing through the brainstem auditory nuclei. And even small deviations in the latency of those can indicate some pathology. For example, demyelinating disease. Then if we pick up at 10 milliseconds here, and we go from 10 out to say 50, you can see again there are some mid-latency components as well. Now, most psychophysiologists, human psychophysiologists, won't be paying a lot of attention to these components. They'll be more interested in these components. These are going to change their amplitude based on things like attention, memory, arousal, individual differences in cognition or emotion, whereas these are pretty much invariant across any healthy individual. Okay. These might be more medically or diagnostically useful. These might be more psychologically interesting from a research standpoint. I'll come back and show you more of that as well. This picture comes right from the textbook chapter by Fabiani, Graton, and Federmeyer. Okay. Now, this just gets back to that issue of the time-locked activity and how we can extract it by averaging the signals. So there are 4 columns here, and notice that each one has a different scale. This is 40 microvolts. Now we're half 20, half again 10, and half again 5. And in this first column, we see a bunch of individual trials. So time 0 is very close to the beginning here. It's at the same point for all of them. And this is just one epoch of activity. It obviously has the event-related potential embedded somewhere in there and a lot of background noise. In this next column, there are 2 waveforms, the first of which is an average. So this is, you know, adding them all together and dividing by the number of them. The second one is a clever technique known as the plus-minus average. You take the first epoch, you subtract the second. You take the third, you subtract the fourth. You take the fifth, subtract the sixth. So you're alternating, adding and subtracting the epochs. Well, if you have a signal that's present invariantly, the signal is now present when you have an odd number of epochs, and then when you subtract an epoch, so if you have one epoch, it's present, now you subtract the next epoch, it's gone. You add the third epoch, it's there. You add subtract the fourth epoch, it's gone. So as long as you do an even number of these, the plus-minus average represents the average background activity without the signal. Okay. So when you look here, just averaging a few adjacent epochs together, it doesn't look vastly different between the typical average and the plus-minus average. But now you get out here, averaging quite a few of them together, and you see there's some clear, discernible voltage pattern here that you don't see in the average that's devoid of the signal. And when you have a bunch of these averaged together, then you get a very clear difference now. So here is the event-related potential that we think is present on each and every trial, and here is an estimate of the background noise. So you can still see, even riding on top of this, there might be noise that's that large. Okay? Another way of looking at the estimate of how the noise might happen is you could divide your epochs into 2 subsets and create 2 averages and superimpose them. And that's what's done here. So to the extent that these 2 things differ, we think that's just due to residual noise that hasn't averaged out. Okay. Assuming that these don't represent like 2 distinct points in time, but they're just taking, you know, randomly sampling trials from the entire period and assigning them to one or the other average. And you can see, you know, they look pretty close, and there's some very clear discernible features as well. So that's how signal averaging works. It's a robust technique. It's used very often, and it's the main way of deriving an event-related brain potential. Okay. So the classic view, and of course it wasn't considered a classic view when it was first proposed, just like, you know, classic Coke wasn't considered classic Coke when it was just Coke, or World War I wasn't considered World War I when it was the Great War. But it was just classic view now because we have an alternative view, and I'll talk about that alternative view later. But the classic view is that you can time-lock activity, that there's an invariant signal, and you can extract it by averaging. So we assume that the background activity is noise, and it's really uncorrelated with the stimulus that we're interested in. Okay. And activity that reflects the processing of the stimulus, whether it be perceptual processing, categorization, maybe something to do with memory or attention, decision-making, response selection, and response execution, all of that is going to reflect the signal. Okay. And the signal-related activity can be extracted because it's time-locked to that stimulus or potentially that response if that's what we're locking to. And the background activity is not. So it's the most common method for extracting the signal. So we take EEG and we sample for around 1 second after each stimulus with a little bit just beforehand for a baseline so we can see how things change from a baseline. And then, as I've shown you, the time-locked signal emerges and the noise averages to zero. And an important consideration if you're designing an experiment is that your signal-to-noise ratio increases as a function of the square root of the number of trials in the average. So, you know, if you go from 5 to 25 trials, you've doubled your signal-to-noise ratio. But to do that again, you'll have to go from 25 to 200, 400, 500, 25 squared, 625. So yeah, you'd have to really go high to double it again. So you'll see really nice increases in your signal-to-noise ratio over some, you know, limited number, and then you're going to have to really, really have a lot of trials to get further increase. If you're familiar with the standard error of the mean, this is the same principle. So you're trying to get an estimate of the mean, and there's some noise around that, and your degree of precision in estimating the mean will go up as a function of the square root of the number of observations in the sample. Same principle. Okay. Pragmatic impact is you need enough trials, but beyond that, you're going to have to probably, you know, put your subject to sleep in order to get enough trials.
So at what point do you determine that you've had enough trials?
Probably by looking at some indicators that you have a clear signal that's distinct from the background noise. And it's going to depend on what component you're interested in. So here we obviously have enough trials because in these two comparison averages there's very little noise. Or looking here we have a very clear signal and a small estimate of noise. If we were interested in a brainstem component, like one of those very early components, we might have to have 4,000 trials because they're so small. So the larger the component you're interested in, the fewer trials in general you would need. For many cognitive studies, you might be able to get by with 30 to 60 trials per condition. But for brainstem auditory evoked responses, you might need 4,000 trials per condition.
And then you compare some experiment to all the tests.
So,
data from all the trials.
Right. So you're going to take data from all those trials, and they will create one waveform. And then you'll do some kind of quantification on that one waveform that's the average of everything. That averages, though, for each subject. So let's get a picture again.
So these change a lot. They're, like, really dependent on the situation, right?
Well, yeah, ideally
so
they'd be...
You can't, like, have the same person come in, like, next week. You would have to do it over, right?
Well, you would hope that if memory effects or, you know, other kinds of practice effects aren't a big problem, you should get a very similar result in a person the next time as well. Okay, so this, for example, might be the average of, I don't know how many trials here, maybe, you know, 100 trials. And so each subject now would just have one of these two waveforms. We'll take it here. So this waveform, you might calculate the microvoltage associated with the peak. You might do something in terms of the area under that area. So then each subject would have one measure. And now you could compare that value across two conditions, like novel and rehearsed, learned and unlearned, attended, unattended, or across individuals, schizophrenic and control. Okay, so what does the ERP then reflect? Well, it could reflect really any part of the stage of perceiving and responding to a stimulus. So it can reflect sensory events, motor events, and or cognitive operations in the brain. And we wouldn't know which without kind of linking these various peaks and troughs that we see in the ERP to various experimental manipulations. And they would reflect synchronous and phase-locked activities of large neuronal populations in order to be visible at the surface of the skull, surface of the scalp, and that they would have to be, you know, engaged reliably every trial during that task. Okay, so a component then is just this bump or this trough, and this is that same picture you saw before. We'll talk about various components here. We'll have some things to say about the P300, something known as the N400. We'll talk about the P1 and the N1 and so on. You can see, look how small these components are. This is again in response to the question about how many trials you need. This is 0.2 microvolts. So that's a 0.2 microvolt. Maybe this is a whole microvolt here that we're looking at. That's a very small signal. And if it's embedded in 50 microvolts of noise from trial to trial, you can see why you'd need so many. On the bright side, these things occur with, you know, 10 milliseconds of latency, so you can get 4,000 trials in a hurry. people who go through these studies just listen to lots of click after click after click after click, and it doesn't take very long at all. On the other hand, these are very large. You see, it's about 2 microvolts. Maybe that's 10 microvolts now for the P300. But you're going to have to get that, you know, one stimulus every couple of seconds or so. So it might take longer to get. Okay. These components are labeled beyond the brainstem components get Roman numerals. The mid-latency components get N's and P's with these little subscripts that are A's and O's and things. And then the components that we'll focus on primarily have one of two nomenclatures. They'll all have N or P, N for negative and P for positive. And by convention, negative is usually up and positive is usually down, but there are some renegades in the field who like to do it the other way around. I think I mentioned earlier in the lecture, this is an historical artifact because the early polygraphs were such that the pen motor would go down when there was a positive voltage and it would go up when there was a negative voltage. And so polygraphers got used to looking at, you know, positive down, negative up, and we just kind of carried that through. I personally am more accustomed to looking at them this way, but people who look at them the other way will actually go to the trouble of even, you know, using Photoshop to flip the whole thing around so that they can look at them positive up. Okay. So N or P, and then they're either labeled by latency, so N100 would come at about 100 milliseconds, P300 would come somewhere around 300 milliseconds. This system breaks down a little bit because these later components may vary from person to person and depending on the cognitive processing involved. In fact, the latency of this P300 is an important variable that we'll talk about a little bit later. So sometimes they're also labeled just N1, P1, meaning the first major positive bump, the first major negative bump. P3, although P3 has several different variants, and we'll talk about P3A and P3B later today or next time as well. But that's the general nomenclature that we're dealing with. Okay, so making meaning from these bumps is another issue, and you know, it's really not that different than any science that tries to make meaning from bumps. Here we of course have a science that wasn't so successful. This is bumpology in this beautiful rendering here, or phrenology in other words. And the text on the bottom says, "Pores over the cranial map with learned eyes, each rolling hill and bumpy knoll decries, here secret fires, and their deep minds of sense, his touch detects beneath each prominence." So, it's probably somebody who's only seen at a carnival today. Hopefully our bumps have stronger correlates than bumpology of the past. Okay. So I've talked a little bit about labeling these peaks and troughs. Yeah, we've done that, okay. By P or N and latency. And then once we've identified a particular peak, you need some quantitative measure of that peak that you can then subject to statistical analysis. So you could quantify the amplitude, how negative, how positive is that peak, and that would be taken presumably right at the peak, okay, which in this would be no trouble at all, but of course the real waveforms have, you know, little bits of noise, and so sometimes it, you know, will bounce around a little bit. So that's one measure. Latency, of course, is another one, and the latency is just the time at which the peak or the trough occurs. So you decide where is the maximum positive value and what is the time of that. So this would appear to be like a P415, let's say. So that would be 415 milliseconds in that case. You can also look at the area under a peak. And so in this diagram, it doesn't seem that the area would be, here's baseline, we'd look at the area from some window. We usually would find out what's the peak in the grand average and go plus or minus some distance. So let's say we wanted to go plus or minus 100 milliseconds from here. So we look at a 200 millisecond window and we just sum all the voltages in there. That would be the area. Now the reason that can be useful is if a waveform's a little bit noisy, then the peak could be capriciously high or low, just depending on where the noise is. But the average of all those peaks is going to give you a better representation of how much kind of general neural activity is giving rise to this peak. So the area is another measure. A measure that's not used very often is a string measure, but I figure just for completeness I would throw it up here. The string measure you'd get yourself a string, or I guess you could do it digitally now, and you just lay that string over here till it fits, and then you measure how long the string is. There was an interesting but kind of abandoned literature on intelligence and longer string measure. Okay? So people who have greater intelligence had longer strings, meaning they had more dispersion from baseline. Okay. And there are other fancy things, and we'll talk about that in advanced topics, but for now let's just think about the amplitude, which can either be the peak or the area, and the latency would be the main measures that we'd be interested in. Okay. All right, so in terms of these components, I've talked a little bit about these early waves that, you know, happen in the first 10, 12 seconds. Waves 1 through 6 represent evoked activity in the auditory pathways of the nuclei of the brainstem. And all early components that are, you know, less than 60 to 100 milliseconds, so that's going to include these very early brainstem components and what I call the mid-latency components, they occur in an obligatory fashion. That is, you know, if you're tired, if you're sleeping, if you're, you know, a little bit under the weather, these will occur unless you have some major pathology in the sensory systems involved. So they're often called exogenous. They're determined by things outside of the organism. Exo, outside. So these, what determines the amplitude of these components is the presence and perhaps the intensity of the stimulus. It has nothing to do with the internal state of the organism other than the person is, you know, is intact. And subtle deviations in the appearance of these, either the morphology or the latency, can be indicative of pathology, like demyelinating disease, like multiple sclerosis, for example. Now, the later ERP components are potentially more interesting to people who are interested in cognitive psychology, CNS, clinical psychology, because they're sensitive to changes in the state of the organism, the meaning of the stimulus, and what's demanded in the task. So the same physical stimulus can produce vastly different ERPs depending on how it's interpreted, and that gets pretty interesting. So these are often called endogenous, means they're determined within the organism. So, and I'll show you an example in a little bit of one that's very clearly determined within the organism because it's what happens when a stimulus is omitted. So there's no physical stimulus, you can still see something time-locked to when it should have occurred. So those are endogenous. And then there's a bunch of things that aren't really neatly exogenous or endogenous in that they're modulated, they're pretty much obligatory, but they're modulated by psychological factors. So P1 and N1, for example, are going to occur pretty much in an obligatory fashion in an awake, intact organism, but they'll be modulated by things like attention. So they fall into this kind of funny category. They're obligatory, but they're still modulated by factors within. So the term mesogenous, not MY but ME, has been proposed for this. And actually, in this revision of the textbook chapter was the first time I saw this. And I think this has been one of those kind of, you know how adolescents corrupt the language? I think the adolescent psychophysiologists who are now like my age have corrupted the language, and this now appears in print in your textbook. So I haven't done a thorough history of that, but I'm kind of curious because I'd never seen it in print prior to looking at the chapter before this lecture. Okay, but it just gets the idea. There's a continuum here. There's things that are clearly obligatory, they're exogenous. Things that are clearly non-obligatory and only depend upon the meaning of the stimulus, those are endogenous, and these things in between that are moderated or modulated, those are mesogenous. Okay. So you have these components, but you know, how do you know what the definition of a component is? And you can find a positive peak at a certain latency. Is it always the same component? And the answer would have to be no, and you might need some other things to help you define it. And there's no one way to define it, but some ways that people do approach defining these components is the obvious one. What, you know, is there a positive or a negative peak at a various latency? And I'd add to that at particular scalp locations. So for example, the P3 component, that late positive component that I showed you, typically is maximal over the parietal region. And if it's not, then it might be a different variant of that component. Okay. Additionally, these components are often defined within some kind of construct network of different associations. And so the components have functional associations. They covary across subjects, across conditions, or across scalp locations, or in response to experimental manipulations. So The P3 component that we talked about is a component whose amplitude is large when something is perceived as rare and significant, for example. It's something that we see in conditions where it's significant, where it's rare. It has this parietal maximum. These would be several features that might help you know that it's a P3 of the classic variety. And ideally, but seldom, these would also be defined by the neuronal structures that give rise to these components. Now, for some of these earlier components, we've mapped the surface potentials very clearly onto the generators underneath. But for things later than P1N1, this gets tricky because by that point, a few hundred milliseconds after the stimulus, there are multiple brain regions involved in generating these potentials. So there are distributed generators, and that gets kind of thorny to try to identify them. So you'd be in the best shape if you said, I have a negative potential 80 to 120 milliseconds after a response. It's largest on error trials, and it's localized in the anterior cingulate. Okay. I'm describing one potential, the error-related negativity that we'll talk about, but seldom do you get to have that degree of specificity. Okay. I'm thinking this might be a good time to take a break, but let me pause and see if people have any questions before we take the break.
How do they find the underlying structures?
Isn't that
the inverse problem?
There is an inverse problem that, you know, any pattern of surface electrical activity could plausibly be generated by, you know, a large number, if not an infinite number, of generators. It's kind of like saying you see lots of waves in the ocean, what started the waves, right? But you can constrain those hypotheses so that some of them can be ruled out pretty easily. And if you have imaging data to show you where in an imaging study are pieces of cortex differentially active in this task, then that's a nice hypothesized generator. And I'll show you an example of that a little bit later here today. Okay. Take a break. All right. Okay, any questions that came to mind over the break? Okay. Okay, so event-related potentials can come in a couple of varieties. They're evoked, as the name implies, they're evoked by some external stimulus to begin with, and emitted would come from some internal event, so absence of a physical stimulus. For example, if there's a sequence that's going along and you predictably expect an item and it doesn't occur, you'll show some event-related activity to the absence of that stimulus. That would be an emitted potential. So evoked are more commonly studied because you can control all the parameters, but emitted are kind of interesting. Evoked potentials can have both the exogenous and the endogenous peaks to them, because there are going to be some things that come in obligatory fashion following the physical parameters of the stimulus, and there are others that may or may not come depending on the meaning of the stimulus and some individual differences. But emitted components, since there is no stimulus, will only have endogenous components. Okay? So here's an example of this. What we have here are different tasks where they're going to count a 70 dB tone or a 40 dB tone. A 70 dB tone is emitted, or they're going to ignore a 70 dB tone. The open triangles reflect the N1 P2 complex that you see. These are pretty much exogenous components. They may be moderated by attention. Maybe they're mesogenous, but they're present when the physical stimulus is present. And you also see, for example, here, that it's modulated by the physical intensity of the stimulus. So a 70 dB tone produces a larger dispersion around the mean than the 40 dB tone, also suggesting it's an exogenous component. And in all these cases, you know, there's a probable stimulus and then an improbable stimulus. So this is when they're trying to count 70s, and when it occurs improbably, you also get this little modulation. There's a P3 right here, so that's a later component when it occurs unexpectedly. The important thing here is when there's a bunch of 70 hertz or 70 dB tones that are occurring and then one is emitted, what we see is obviously no N1-P2 complex because there's no tone there, but a very clear P3-like component to its emission. So it's an oddball, it's unexpected, it's emitted, there's no stimulus there, and yet people still show event-related activity. So that's probably the strongest evidence that the P3 is an endogenous component because you don't need the physical stimulus in order to see it.
That happened at regular intervals so that the emission would be when it was expected?
Well, so the stimuli come at regular intervals, but the emission itself can be random, but always, the general timing is expected, but when the emission occurs is not. So it'd be boop, 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 you know, so you'd know.
The P3 would happen in response to the emission of the expected.
Right, so the way you do that is since there's no stimulus to lock the trial to, you'd lock the trial to the predicted time of the stimulus. So if the stimuli are occurring every second, then you'd know that this was where it should have occurred, and now we can look at the activity following that point in time. Now the other thing to notice is when a stimulus is deviant, but it's a physical stimulus, it produces a fairly focused, you know, pointed P3. Whereas when it's omitted, this is much broader. And that's probably because people's internal timing isn't quite as locked to anything that's omitted, right? So what's probably happening is it's varying a little bit in terms of exactly where it would occur. Okay. Now, event-related potentials are very useful in terms of their temporal precision. They're not quite as useful in terms of their spatial precision. And so you've probably seen maps like this if you've read chapters on neuroimaging. And this is just designed to show how specific can a measure be spatially, ranging from whole brain to some topographical map to a column of cortex to a layer of cortex to a neuron all the way down to the synapse. And how precise can it be in the temporal dimension? So this is a time-space plot. And ideally, you know, you'd like a measure that would let you see, you know, everything, one measure to take care of it all, and of course there is no such measure. But magnetoencephalography and event-related potentials are going to let you see things on the order of whole brain and kind of surface maps, but with really, really good temporal resolution. Not so good, though, in terms of the spatial resolution, getting down to, you know, levels of the column, for example. Whereas fMRI, on the other hand, has resolution on the order of, you know, maybe seconds or so, but can actually get down to voxels that would represent, you know, places within a column. Okay. So if you want, you know, real specificity, you have to start going invasive. And so single cell recording gets down to the level of a neuron and can capture changes over all kinds of dimensions. So to get better spatial resolution, you have to get more invasive, usually. Now, spatial localization is more difficult with ERPs. So, you know, at the surface, we're just recording the activity of functional synaptic units. And ERPs are generated by groups of cells that are synchronously activated and geometrically organized in a way so that we can detect their activity. So, for example, here are three kinds of cell groups that you might encounter. These are all nice and parallel, dendrites up and axons down. This might be something like you'd see in cortical tissue right up near the surface. And those are great because they produce a dipole orientation where you see things in one direction positive and the other direction are negative. So you would be able to detect that activity if you're recording, you know, distant from it. So as long as you have a large enough population of neurons in that configuration, you should be able to see something on the surface. On the other hand, there are probably places in the brain that there can be activity, but there would be no activity detectable at a distance from it, so it would be a closed field. So what happens here is activity comes in. These are all oriented kind of, you know, equal and opposite all the way around, so when activity happens, the positivities and negativities offset in a way that at a distance, recording at any two locations, you would detect no voltage difference. That might represent certain kinds of nuclei. I guess we really don't know how important things like that are for surface recording. You can't see them. And then open-closed fields produce kind of different patterns that are a little bit more complex. This would be an example of a cell body or a nucleus, a bunch of cell bodies that have axons going out together, but in dendrites in all directions. And you can see they produce a more complicated field that might vary across the scalp. Now, a lot of the methods that we use to try to infer where EEG activity might be coming from, okay, you can't infer it definitively, but we try to model it, assume the first kind of field, a dipole, a single dipole where things are lining up in that way. Okay. Now, this would just show a single dipole then that might be located near the thalamus, for example, and what it might look like on the surface, so that, you know, electrodes up here are going to detect greater and lesser degrees of positivity, electrodes down here, greater or lesser degrees of negativity. And even if you happen to have two electrodes, one at CZ and one, say, at PZ, you detect a difference because the strength of positivity is different at those two locations. And remember, we're measuring voltage differences. The only place you wouldn't detect any difference is if you had an electrode here referenced right to here, but yeah, you probably would record with more than just that. Okay. Now, one of the problems, though, for inferring the activity is that rarely would we have just one focal localized group of cells synchronously active. They're going to be distributed across the brain. And so inferring the location can be difficult. My brother does work with localizing activity in the earth. He's a geophysicist. And I asked him about this problem because the problem is the same with earth tremors too. Except I asked him how he localizes it, and he said, well, there's only one location. So if there's only one location, if we would make the assumption there's only one location for this pattern of activity, we could localize it like that. But the brain is much more complicated than the earth. So we have to contend with that. Now, I talked last time about the possibility of bipolar or monopolar recording, monopolar being a relatively inactive reference. That's what's typically used in ERP research. So we're looking at activity that's picked up at one site relative to some reasonably inactive reference site. Most often you're going to see this as an average mastoid or an average ears reference. Now, localization is not impossible, but it's not going to be a definitive answer. So when you look at MRI data and you look at activations, you can gripe about the experimental paradigm, you can have an argument about what it means, but there's never an argument about this is the place where the changes in blood oxygenation occurred. So it's spatially definitive. With ERPs, you can say this is the best plausible generator that I have for this surface potential. And then the reviewers are going to ask you, well, what are your data? Why is that plausible? You say, well, it accounts for all but 2% of the surface variance. And they would say, well, big deal. Is it in a plausible location? Yeah, well, it's in a plausible location because this location makes sense given what we know about the cognitive processes. Stronger data yet. And this region shows task-dependent changes in other imaging modalities like fMRI or PET. And people with lesions in this area can't do the task well. So if you put all those together, then you say, all right, we've got data from lesion methods, from functional neuroimaging that has anatomical precision, and we show that if we put a hypothesized generator there, it accounts for our scalp activity. This would be the strongest evidence that you could have. Now, the reason you'd want to do that is not just to be redundant with another imaging modality, but to take advantage then of the temporal precision of EEG with the spatial precision of another imaging modality. So I'll show you a little bit of data later where we see that some PET data found particular regions active, and then P1, a fairly early visual component, fits if you put dipoles in that location. So multimodal imaging is probably a very good idea with respect to taking advantages of both of them. Okay. So that being said, you need to be aware that you don't want to just interpret the scalp topography as reflecting activity directly beneath the area where it's maximum. Sometimes it will be, but sometimes you can really get into trouble. The generator could be, for example, in a gyrus pointing to the opposite hemisphere, or down in a sulcus, excuse me. So you see maximal activity here, it's tempting to think, oh, it's in the gyrus and it's pointing out here, but it could be maybe in some sulcus that's causing the field to be picked up. So you have to be careful about interpreting it. If it's merely a correlational description that maximum parietal surface activity correlates with this, you're not in any trouble. But if you then want to make the inference that parietal activity is giving rise to this, then you'd need some you know, substantiating data. Okay. So just one more time. Late ERP components, I don't think you should take to indicate the existence of some neurological substrate of cognitive processing. And it's tempting with all imaging data. Somebody has a paradigm, they're seeing differences, you've got robust reaction time differences and they're replicable, and now people want some other measure. But, you know, this is just another measure. It's not privileged in some sense, and, you know, because we don't know exactly where it's occurring or does it reflect any kind of neurological substrate. It's just a correlate. I would say anything after 100 milliseconds could be late. So these brainstem components and those mid-latency auditory components, I think you can assume reflect the substrate of the processing. But beyond that, without you know stronger data, we have to go back to the problem of is this a substrate or is it a correlate? Okay. I would probably say if you're interested in things like T1, you might be closer to the substrate. It might be tapping some neurological activity in a substrate of aspects of visual perception. So things like P3, it's got so many contributors, I think you have to think of it as a correlate.
Is there a way of measuring EEG while you're undergoing fMRI?
Yes. It's not without its technological hurdles, but there's an article that I've assigned for one of the advanced topics that talks about how to do it. Two problems. You want to make sure that your EEG electrodes don't interfere with your fMRI, and of course it's a huge magnet, and many of the electrodes we would typically use have magnetic properties, which means they'd be sucked off the head and into the magnet, and even in the absence of that, they would cause lots of artifacts. The other problem is that the magnet, by being a large magnetic field, any movement in the magnet will create electrical potentials. And people, as still as they can be, will still have regular movements, for example, due to ballistocardiogram effects. And so if somebody's just sitting in the scanner with the EEG electrodes on, you're not even actively scanning, you'll see this pulsatile artifact that exceeds the voltage of the EEG. And then when you turn the scanner on, there's huge radio frequency pulses that just completely obscure the EEG. It's an artifact that can be dealt with, but it's you wouldn't want to try it without some experience.
So the EEG would provide the temporal accuracy and the fMRI could provide the spatial accuracy.
Exactly. So, right. You get the temporal resolution of the EEG and the spatial resolution of the fMRI. Mm-hmm. And then if you have, you know, 14 activations, you might actually be able to say what order they occur in. And that'd be ideal. But, you know, let's say you have a few activations and, you know, theory would dictate it should be in one order. You can see if the ERP data would support that. Okay. So, you know, we have to validate this empirically. And this is just, I guess, to remind us that what a charming field for scientific observation. We need to validate what we see on the surface. Okay. All right. So let's take a look at just how we process these signals in their basic form. So, as I mentioned, if this is time-locked to some event, we have to have precise control over the timing of that event. So that rules out certain kinds of stimuli for ERP experiments. You can't look at an ERP to a movie, for example. Now, maybe if you had the right kind of movie, you could look at an ERP to specific things that happen again and again in the movie. Like every time someone is shot in a violent movie, or every time a car crashes in one of those car crash movies. Not that these are theoretically interesting. You know, there could be some events in a movie, but you couldn't just play it and get something. Auditory stimuli, again, would have to be pretty focused in their delivery. Single syllable words, single tones, you know, song or symphony isn't going to help because it's going to be far too long. Now, some people interested in processing of music might have some ongoing stream of music and then some kind of predicted deviation, and then you can look at how the brain responds to that predicted deviation. So these things are often going to be presented either very short auditory stimuli or visual stimuli presented under tight control using a stimulus presentation program on a computer. And because you don't see things on individual trials very easily, you need to present stimuli numerous times. And if you're interested in a stimulus that occurs as an oddball, as we sometimes are for things like P3, then if you need, say, 30 trials of the oddball, and it's only occurring 10% of the time, then you need 300 trials overall to get that. So you have to really think about, is this going to be feasible for my subject to do? Okay. Now, on the bright side, ERPs are thought not to habituate, at least not as much as peripheral measures, but there's some evidence that they may do some degree of habituation or change over time, but it's certainly less than peripheral measures. Now, you have to have some indication, coincident with your EEG data, of when the event occurred. So, a couple of methods for that. Sometimes an event channel can just be sent in like another EEG channel. You could imagine if you had a little optical sensor on your computer screen, every time the light changed luminance, it could change the signal intensity, and then you just have a channel that's essentially no activity and then bright, you know, lots of activity when the signal is bright. Or for a tone, sometimes you just play the audio stream into the data stream. So you'd have a channel, nothing, 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 and then there's a tone, you'd see the waveform of the tone. You can also just have the stimulus computer send some kind of code in, so you'll actually see a code occur at the time that the event occurred. And that's the method we use in the lab, so that the stimulus computer that's presenting the stimuli at the time it comes up sends out a binary code through a cable to the amplifier, and it just knows that that's not data, that's just a timing event. But you have to have the timing locked in there. These get trickier if you don't have your systems communicating quite as in an integrated way. Another thing sometimes people do is they'll have one system start the other system, like the stimulus system might be start the acquisition, and then keep an ongoing time track so you know that, you know, this event happened 1 minute and 30.3 seconds into the file. I'm a little more nervous about that method because then the timing stream is entirely separate from the data stream. Okay. There's a couple of methods for then sampling this. Most systems now sample continuously. So what you do is you get everything set up and you just start recording, and then the data are being collected to the hard drive, digitized as we go at the sample rate you choose, and you start presenting stimuli and they'll come on in. If you are sampling at a ridiculously high rate or you have a ridiculously old system, you might not be able to sample continuously, and so you can sample just as the pulse is received. So the system can always be monitoring what's there, and when the event occurs, it can take what's in memory, say a couple hundred milliseconds back, and then the next second or so, and just write that chunk to the file. So that's another option. Okay. No matter how you do it, you want to be sure to at least have a few samples prior to the onset of the stimulus, so you can compare to a pre-onset baseline. Everything's going to be relative to some pre-onset baseline. And as you're collecting or as you're analyzing, you're going to have to decide on what's the proper length of data you want to look at. So if you're interested in brainstem auditory evoked responses that occur only over 10 milliseconds, your epics could be a couple milliseconds before and 15 milliseconds after, and you have everything you need. If you're looking at the P3, you might need to have a whole second of data after the stimulus onset. And then we take epics that come from similar stimuli and average them together to create the event-related potential, which is an average response for that particular condition. Okay. So there are a couple of assumptions then with averaging. Do you have a question?
I might have been, so before you said ERPs generally don't habituate.
Right.
What happens when they do, given the way that averaging
is? It's, if they don't change their morphology greatly, but you just see a decrease in the component of interest, then you would need more trials over time. Okay. But there's not a lot of evidence for them habituating over the whole experiment, but there might be local fluctuations that you'd see that might, you know, go with things like how alert the person is, how motivated they are, how much they're attending. But to the extent that happens, it could change either the amplitude or the timing of the individual trial, and that's going to create more noise in your ultimate average.
Can this be like a real event that happens, the habituation, like the sensitization effect?
Mm-hmm.
I saw just a study on media violence. And
yeah.
They measured the sensitization as a latest potential after exposure to violence.
Right. Right. I think it's, yeah, the nature of the stimuli would be very important in determining habituation. And so maybe this claim that ERPs don't habituate as much as autonomic measures may also reflect something about the nature of the stimuli. That a lot of ERPs are done to stimuli that don't have an inherent emotional value. But as more people interested in emotion start using ERPs, I could imagine you'd have to really keep fresh the intensity of the stimuli. So if you're interested in violence effects, unfortunately you have to have a lot of really gruesome stimuli. Or if you're interested in, you know, happy emotion, you have to have a lot of different but happy eliciting stimuli. Because there could be some, so, but that would reflect kind of habituation in terms of how intense the stimulus is perceived. But if you could calibrate it in a way that each stimulus is kind of equally intense in terms of the dimension you're interested in, then we presume the ERP should be similar each and every time. Okay. So we make a couple of assumptions. One is that the signal and the noise in each epoch just sum linearly to produce the recorded waveform. That would happen if they're independent. If the background activity is independent of the ERP, this would happen. But if they're somehow interacting with each other, then this assumption wouldn't hold. And the degree of the signal would change based on the degree of background activity. And that's one of the biggest criticisms of this classic view. And we'll talk about an alternative view that suggests that it's a reorganization of background activity that gives rise to the ERP. And we make the assumption that the signal, the waveform that's due to the stimulus, is invariant. It's absolutely identical across each and every presentation. To the extent it's not, you're going to have more noise in your final average. And we assume that the noise is statistically independent of the signal, and it's just a random sample of a background noise process. And so if that's the case, it will tend to average towards the mean, and since these are AC amplifiers, that mean is zero. Now, one of the things that we often do with ERPs is to filter them to get rid of some of the higher frequency activity that we wouldn't be interested in. So even though you have lots of trials and you average them together, there may be some noise in the waveform. And we saw that in that diagram with the plus minus waveforms. Even that final waveform, when we superimposed the two on top of each other, they were slightly different. That would be some noise. So if you're interested in some slower components, especially later and even slower components, then you might use a low-pass filter. So here is the same actual data presented with three different filters. So this top one is passing all signals that are less than 12.5 hertz. And here's the stimulus onset right here. And you can see there almost appears to be some alpha activity still present in the waveform. The next one is an 8 hertz filter. And now you can see there's a P1, N1, P2, N2, P3 complex. And that's pretty clear. And then if you use a 5 hertz filter here in lime green, you can see I've kind of really smoothed those things, but then P3 clearly stands out as pretty distinct. Now, if you just superimpose those, though, one of the things you'll notice with each of these filters, we're starting to reduce the amplitude of the P3 as well. So there is some trade-off. You'll see it more clearly, but on the other relative to the other components, but you may also reduce the amplitude. One question, maybe you could say, well, this is the real signal. Maybe this is noise. But if it's meaningful, you'll be filtering it out. So you probably, if you're getting into a field, want to see what are the filters that people usually use in the paradigms of interest and try to model yours after that, because otherwise you could find some very different effects just by using a different filter. Just looking at this, I'd argue that the 12.5 hertz filter didn't do enough. We either need more trials or a better filter, because this is clearly some alpha bleeding through. You can see it all the way through here. So I would probably feel more comfortable with either the 8 hertz or the 5 hertz filter, the red or the green. Okay. So let's take a look at some data processing so you can see actually how this works. So what we have here are about 32 channels of data, and we're looking at about 5 seconds here. Nothing's happening just yet. I'll go out here to where some events occur. So here's a code of 100, and that means some stimulus has occurred. Now, this is a very simple paradigm. 9 out of every 10 trials is a green rectangle, and 1 out of every 10 trials is a purple rectangle, and they're supposed to detect the rare rectangle. This isn't scientifically very interesting, but it's really a good example of the oddball paradigm, so we should see a big P3 response. Now, when you look at this, one thing you notice very prominently are these discursions here, and these are blinks, and obviously they're much larger than the ERP activity itself. So we'll have to deal with those. And as you go along, 100s are the frequent condition, 100, 100, 100, 100, 100, 100, 100, 100. Oh, there was a 101. So right here occurred an oddball right there at this point right here. And you see there's not a real easily discernible change in the EEG there compared to the next one. The blink looks a little later, but I don't know if that's a reliable feature, for example. We don't have the response data embedded in this file. That's possible to do, but it's just not in this file right here. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is to chop this up into epochs surrounding the event so that I can then average things together. So to do that, I'm just going to epoch it. That's now a verb, to epoch. And we'll use the event codes that are already in here. If you had events in some external file, for example, that was kept track of by some other program, you could import that file. I'm going to go from 250 milliseconds before the stimulus to 1,000 milliseconds after the stimulus. So here's the minus 250 to 1,000. And I'll give it some name, like, I guess I've done this before, so it's now going to be an epoch file. This was subject 999, which is the pilot subject here. So all it's going to do is go through the file. If it sees an event, then it's going to chop it from 250 milliseconds before to 1 second after, and then that will be an epoch that it will toss into a file. It does that. Boom. And there it is. So now what I have are individual epochs, and if I march through, some trials have blinks, most trials have blinks, but not all trials have blinks. And that's what you see from trial to trial. Now, most of those were type 100, which was my code for the frequent event. And if I go ahead one more trial, this is type 101, which is the infrequent event. If you went through here by yourself and just tried to see what's the difference between type 100 and type 101, you'd probably have a hard time visually seeing anything because the signal's really embedded in there. Now, we're going to have to do something with these blinks. One solution is just to toss all the trials with blinks, but if we did that, we wouldn't have enough to get a reliable average. So I'm going to do something that we'll talk about how it's done at another lecture, but I'm going to try to estimate the extent to which this channel, the ocular channel, is contributing to the EEG. So this is actually a derivation that's two sites very close to the eye. So to the extent that EEG activity is present, it shouldn't be present very much because it's a differential subtraction of one site versus the other. So the EEG shouldn't be very different between those sites, and the only activity we should see is ocular. So we assume this is noise plus a little EEG we hope we don't care about, and there's the very clear blink, and it's about 150 microvolt discursion from baseline. Okay. All right, so what I'll do is I'll use this ocular artifact reduction. Notice it doesn't say correction, it's a reduction. And I'm going to select some parameters that just tell it, you're looking for blinks. They might be 250 to 300 milliseconds in length, and it's just going to create a file that I can then use to correct my data. So it's done, and now I'll call it P99 corrected. Should be done, and now I'll open it up. It's an epoch file. So here's my corrected file. Now, if it worked right, let's see, maybe I can put them side by side. Let me close my original continuous file, and then I will tile these guys. So, okay. So right now we're looking at the same data before and after correction. And the correction doesn't actually correct the ocular channel itself, so you could see where the original blink was. So what you notice here at frontal channels like FP1, during the blink bleeds through very clearly, and after we've estimated the contribution of the blink to the EEG and statistically corrected for it, you can see you don't see the blink so clearly. I'll go ahead. It's 3, 4. There's another one. That's what, number 6? So there again, we kind of see the same thing. It appears to have worked, and there are ways that we can assess that. But for now, you say, no, trust me, I'm a doctor. You know, this works. Yes.
If it doesn't correct the ocular channel, why don't they look identical between the two
files? It might be scaled a little bit differently, is my thought. Let's see. Where's my scale bar? Yeah, that ocular channel should look the same. Oh, is that a different epic? There we go. Sorry. Let's see. There's 5 and 5. Yeah, they look different because it was a different epic. Thanks. So now they should look, the ocular channel should look the same. If I go ahead, 1 here and 1 here. They're still looking a
looks like you got that sensitivity error.
Yeah, let's see. There. Now, they look the same now? I just changed the sensitivity. Yeah. So now, what we're really looking at is this channel. Okay. Here, we could do this. Oh, it doesn't let me do a comparison here. Crap. If you laid one on top of the other, it would look, I think, just the same. It's just a scaling issue. Okay, so I'm going to close the uncorrected version of this. And now what I need to do is ensure that the activity prior to the stimulus onset is truly zero. It should be pretty close to that, but you can see that it is overall, this activity is oscillating around zero, but the baseline activity from minus 250 to zero, eyeballing it, I'd say it averages just a little bit above zero. So I'm going to issue a baseline correction where I take the average channel by epic, I average everything in the 250 milliseconds prior to baseline, and I subtract it from the whole epic. It's just going to shift the epic down, so the mean of those samples is zero. So you do, it's called baseline correct. And I can do it by default. It chooses the pre-stimulus interval, which is a pretty sensible one for ERPs. But you could define your own if you needed to, if something else was happening even earlier, for example. So I'll call that baseline corrected. And that'll go really fast. Huh. No, it won't go really fast. I have it open somewhere. I'll try it another way. I'll give it a different name. So pre-stim. Okay, so now I have my baseline corrected version of this. So now if we go back to PZ and look at it, now it looks like everything here in this range is really oscillating around zero.
And I'm sorry, that's the range between negative 250 and zero.
And zero. So all of the activity prior to the stimulus is now defined to be an average of zero. So now everything from every trial, any deviations will be from whatever was happening prior to the stimulus. Okay. So I'll close. So far we've chunked it up, we've epiced it, we've tried to deal with those ocular artifacts, and now we've done a baseline correction. So now, without any filtering, I'm ready just to go ahead and average my data by two conditions. So there's a command called average, and we'll do it in the time domain. What we did when we were doing EEG asymmetry work, we averaged it in the frequency domain. That would take an FFT of each epic first and average those spectra. We don't want to do that. We're going to average in the time domain. So each individual time signal, a vector of time points and voltage, we're going to average together. I'm going to sort so that this only has one of the two types. Let's make it type 100. That was the one that occurred frequently. And this can be complicated. You know, you can have a long list of things there. You can have a range of things there. You just set up your experiment so you have your conditions mapped to these numbers. And never lose that sheet. This is the frequent condition, so I'll call it freak. And away we go. It averages it, and it's done. So there we have it. And there's our event-related averages for this. And so I'll, in a minute, overlay the rare and frequent condition and look at the differences in the P300. So let me minimize this for, I'll close that. And we'll go back to our EPIC file, and I'm going to do the same thing I just did to averages, but choose a different condition. So this time it'll be type 101, which was the rare condition. I'll call it rare. Say OK. And there's my rare condition. So now what I'll do is I'm going to compare the file that's the other condition. So I'm going to compare the frequent condition. And now when I look at P3, or the PZ, the electrode, where P3 should be maximum, I don't know if you can see in the back, this red is the frequent condition. There's not much of any P300 in the red condition. The green, the rare condition, shows a whopping P3. Now you can see this in one subject, and it's really, really clear, and that's because it's a really, really obvious task, right? You'd have to be pretty much asleep not to do this task and detect the purple versus the green rectangle, okay. Or maybe colorblind. But assuming those weren't in play, you get a very big dispersion. Now, one other thing that's interesting is you can map the topography of that effect. Oops, where's my map? There's my map. Okay. So let me make sure. Let me get the right map. Okay. And now if I look right here, you can see the P3 has a huge distribution. Now I would have, can you turn off lights for just a second? I would have predicted it would be really maximum back here and fade a little bit in the front, but you can see it actually has a similar amplitude all the way through the center of the head and falls off from there. But it still has enough of a distribution that I would call it a P3. So what I'm doing is taking, this just takes each of these individual sites and maps it. I find the same thing here if I just look at what does it look like when I put it on the maximum site, CZ and C3 instead of PZ. So now I'm right here, but the time point's probably about the same, and you see the distribution at that time point. As you move along, you can see if there's any kind of changes earlier or later and how those look as you move along the waveform, so it kind of gives you an idea of what's happening. If you have to sometimes change the scale for this to see some effects. So for example, change the minimum and maximum, let's say minus 10 to plus 10. Now the P3 is going to look ridiculous. It's just going to, it overwhelms the whole head. But let's take a look at, say, one of these occipital sites, like, maybe O2. Let's see if we can find anything in terms of the P1N1. We have a clear negativity back here that this is site O2, and so that map looks a little weird. We should have 3 points back there, but it's showing a bit of a lateralized negativity. I wouldn't have expected any laterality. We'd have to check if that's, borne out by statistics. But you can kind of get a sense of where those effects are, and then here's the subsequent positivity also in the back that corresponds to that electrode. So you do a little bit of mapping like that, and that's what you see sometimes after people finally identified their effects. And the mapping is going to be a little bit noisy with just one subject, but as you got more and more subjects together, the topography of the average might kind of clear out some of these little bit of oscillations. Okay. Remember with this program, if you like, the history window shows you exactly what we did. So we did a whole bunch of things, actually, in terms of these commands, just by going through the windows. So we started with opening up a continuous file. Where was that? I think I already had it. Here it is. So open file here was what I did right before we started the class. We opened it up. We epiced it. We opened the epic file. We did the artifact correction. We opened up the corrected file. We issued a baseline correction. We did it twice because the first one couldn't write the file for some reason. We opened up that baseline corrected file, and then we created a sort for the frequent, and we averaged it, and we created a sort for the other one and averaged it. So if you had some data and you walked through these steps and you were pretty happy with that data processing stream, you could just copy these commands and put them into a command file and then replace the subject number and batch all of your subjects. You'd still want to go back and look at every subject, make sure that the ocular correction really worked. Did the data look reasonable? We had one study that befuddled us for a couple of months when it looked like it was just nothing but garbage. It's like we hadn't time-locked Turned out we had our event markers in the wrong place. So we found, you know, when you line the event markers up, everything looks like a, you know, event-related potential. If you don't have them lined up right, it doesn't look like event-related potential. Okay. Any questions or things people would like to see? Yes. The number of trials for the two conditions are different? Yes, that's right. So it would appear we have 43 for the rare and 357 for the frequent. Yeah.
So do you want to later compare the two conditions, or if you want to, how is there a way to control
for the people don't usually control for the number of epics, per se. Now, the P3 is predicated on the assumption that you'll see it to a rare stimulus, so you can't equate the number of epics. If you wanted to try to equate for the amount of noise, you could just sample, you know, the same number of frequent epics, so you had 43 frequent epics and 43 rare epics. Then the noise contribution should be similar between the two. But usually it's not considered an issue for the average in a paradigm like this. Now, it might be considered an issue if you think you're studying memory, but your to-be-remembered items are infrequent, then you might be getting a frequency effect and not just a memory effect. So there might be some other issues with the imbalance, but it wouldn't be one just in terms of running an ANOVA on this, because each subject is going to contribute, for example, an amplitude for the rare trials and an amplitude for the frequent trials, and then you have those two as a repeated measure in some kind of an ANOVA. Yes.
I think that I can detect that there is an event-related potential on about half of the sites.
Uh-huh.
You know, so what does it mean? Does it mean that they measure different stages of interpretation of the signal or of the stimulus, or is it just artifact because of its temporal inaccuracy?
Well, so by eyeballing, you know, I can see why you say you only think you see an event-related potential at some and not all of the sites. There is an event-related potential at all of them, but you don't see all components equally prominently at the different sites. And that's just because of how they propagate to the surface. So you're going to see this, you know, CZ and PZ maximum for P3, for example. Those earlier components like P1 and N1, you're going to see more over the occipital sites, and you can see them there. What's interesting there, actually, look at that. Close this mapping for a second. So P1 isn't very pronounced in this paradigm. N1 is. There's really no difference as a function of color in those first three early components. It happens, those stimuli are processed pretty much the same up until sometime after 200 milliseconds. So you get some evidence of the timing of where that differentiation seems to be made. Now, the mastoid here, we hope to be inactive. So it is relatively inactive, but even it shows a little bit of event-related differentiation. Whether or not this amount will be significant would just depend on the amount of variance across subjects.
So there is no reason to assume that specific stimuli will evoke this potential in some areas but not in others.
Well, I think you would assume that depending on how you set up your paradigm, you'd expect to see a particular potential maximum at some sites and not others. So if you didn't see P3 at PZ and you found it instead at T7 and only T7, people would think that's a little strange. They wouldn't call that a P3. So can we have the lights again? So other questions? One other thing I'll show you just real quickly is filtering on this, and then we'll get back to talking about some of the meaning of these components. Now, ideally you'd filter the continuous data and then average it, but filters are linear, averaging is linear, so the filter of the average is equivalent to the average of the filtered data. The filter has some edge effects, and you'll know why in a couple of lectures, but I'll do a low-pass filter, and I'll give it a nice sharp roll off, and I'll do something like try 8 hertz, because that looked pretty good in that example. Okay. And off we go. And now, it disappeared. Neuroscan is known to do that, sometimes without any explanation or fanfare. I can see somebody watching this on the web and they'll be thinking about buying Neuroscan until this point in the lecture. I don't know if that was filtered already or not. Let's see what happens. We'll apply a filter again. A transform, filter. Again, we'll do a nice low-pass filter. We'll do it at 8 hertz. Okay, you maybe saw it, but it's clearly a little bit smoother than it was, right? Smooth it right out. And the P3 is very, very clear there. And if we now look at the map, load the right map file, and we look. Again, it retains its basic scalp distribution that it had before. It'll be a little easier to pick the peak here. There's no noise at all around it. Okay. Now we'll close Neuroscan intentionally and turn to the lecture. Okay. So let me talk about just applications of some of the early components in the time that we have left. Okay. So you can evaluate sensory function. For example, hearing in populations that might not be able to do a routine hearing test. So, you know, once somebody's of a certain age and they're reliable enough, you can play tones in the ear and they can lift their hand to, you know, whichever ear they're hearing it. But infants or people with certain disorders, if they're mentally retarded, for example, you might need some other way to assess the integrity of the hearing. So you could play tones of various decibel level intensities and look for one of the early waves in the brainstem auditory evoked response, wave 5. So this figure here has 44,000 trials per average. And here, when presented to the left ear and presented to the right ear, we can see wave 5 quite prominently for either ear at 70 dB. Now, in the left ear, even at 30, even at 20, it's still there. When we get down to 10 dB, this person isn't registering the stimulus anymore. But in the right ear, we see it at 70, we see it at 50, but we don't see it at 40. Which would suggest there's some peripheral pathology prior to the brainstem that's that's interfering with the hearing in this ear. So that would be a nice way of evaluating this, for example, in infants if you were concerned about hearing loss. And 4,000 trials sounds like a lot, but remember we're only looking at 15 milliseconds here. So if you presented one every 20 milliseconds, that's 50 a second, 80 seconds, and you're done. It's not too bad. Collect a lot of data that way. But you have to sample pretty fast. So in some ERP, the data that I showed you recently, we sampled at 200 hertz. And so that's one sample every 5 milliseconds. Well, that would only have 3 points here. And you can see, obviously, there's a lot of data points here. So you have a very high sampling rate in something like this. Okay. Now, another interesting application is in the recovery of coma for people in persistent vegetative state. So this is a somatosensory evoked potential. They're stimulating, I believe, on the hand, or is it the wrist? The right and left median nerves. Okay. And they recorded these somatosensory evoked potentials with different references. And what we can see is a clear, obligatory exogenous component at Erb's point, which is somewhere along the nerve. Anybody know where Erb's point is? Okay, but it's not up in the brain. Here we have cervical vertebrae 7, so an electrode there, reference to FZ. So it could be coming from either place. What we'll find out is FZ was inactive and cervical vertebrae 7 was active. And again, you see the component. Now we reference C3 prime and C4 prime right over the somatosensory strip that corresponds to the median nerve. You remember the homunculus and where it would be. And reference to FZ. And there's no differential activity whatsoever, which suggests there's no cortical processing of that median nerve stimulation. So the absence of the cortical response is a bad prognostic sign, and this particular patient continued in a chronic vegetative state for a year after the accident. Now, another application of the early components is looking at the time it takes information to transfer between the two hemispheres. So people might be interested in interhemispheric transfer time, and if you present a stimulus lateralized to one visual field, then it will arrive first at the contralateral occipital cortex. But as long as you don't have a commissurotomy patient, there'll be a lot of connection in between there and the informational transfer. But one question is, how long does it take to transfer? And altered transmission time from one hemisphere to the other has been hypothesized to play a role in different disorders, for example, dyslexia. So one way you could think about doing the experiment if you didn't have a psychophys lab is a reaction time experiment. And if you present something to the left visual field and you're controlling for fixation, it goes first to the right visual cortex. So if we have a response that depends on the right motor cortex, meaning the left hand, it should be faster than the other hand. Right. So if the hand and the visual field match, response time should be faster than if the hand and the visual field don't match. Turns out if you do that, though, there's a lot of variability in reaction time and maybe too much variance to see reliable differences in a paradigm like that. But the early ERP components might not have so much noise, you know, trial-to-trial variability might be a way to look at this. So this was a study done by Cliff Sarin and Richie Davidson, and they had these checkerboards that were subtending less than 1 degree of visual angle presented 2.9 degrees from center, so they're pretty close to the fovea. And they recorded ERPs at 01 and 02. And there is a problem of lateralization that you have to understand for these foveally presented or near foveally presented stimuli. And that is that they project, the parafoveal regions, the regions close to the fovea, project to these inner banks here of the calcarine fissure. So you can see here the activity coming, and then here's your pyramidal cells lined up along the cortex. So something that comes from the left, the right visual field going here is going to end up, well, let's do it the other way around. If we get it from the left visual field, it's going to end up in the right cortex, right? But the orientation is such that it's going to project across and it'll be picked up maximally on the other side. And that's shown over here. So here we have dark is the stimulus. So when you see it dark, that's like a flash of light or some stimulus in that area. So if it's a bilateral stimulus, you see the maximum P1N1 complex here at the central electrode, but you know, going out to both sides. If, on the other hand, you present it to the left visual field, it should then be processed in the right occipital cortex. And yet the maximal potential are at leads 1 and 2, which are over the left occipital cortex. Similarly here, right visual field processed by left occipital cortex, the maximal response, however, is in leads 4 and 5, leads 4 and 5 over the right occipital cortex. So you get these paradoxical results. If you present stimuli more laterally, then instead of projecting here, they'll start projecting over here, and then you'll get the predicted pattern of results. This is a nice example of how you wouldn't want to infer maximum activity under the electrode where the activity is maximum. Okay. So they looked at the P1 or P100 wave, and they looked at the latency of that at the electrode contralateral to presentation so that it would actually match up to this problem we just mentioned. And they did two methods. One is just picking the peak, which, you know, is something we've talked about. The other they measured by looking at cross-lag correlation. And what they do for that is they look at the P1 on each side. So even though I present it to just one side, each side will have a P1 amplitude, right? And I can pick the peak at each. But I can also see if I were to try to correlate the two waveforms, they would correlate highly but not perfectly. And if I shift one in time a little bit back and forth, that correlation will maximize when the peaks are lined up. So it's a cross-correlation procedure. So you have a series of correlations as a function of the lag or the distance between the time points in the two electrodes. And if they offset them by 15 milliseconds, they correlated maximally. And they also showed the peak measures differed by 15 milliseconds as well. So it suggests about a 15 millisecond interhemispheric transfer time. And it was in the predicted direction by anatomy in most of the subjects. It was reliable by both methods, and the reaction time data in this study didn't show reliable differences. So I would suggest, you know, it's a nice way of measuring interhemispheric transfer time I wouldn't say that that would correspond to all different regions. It's only, of course, for simple visual information that's presented paraphobially. Okay. Now, P1 and N1 have been studied extensively with attention. There are lots of different studies, but I really like this. This is from Steve Luck's Trends in Cognitive Science article that shows the idealized waveform, and this can summarize about 100 studies right here, so you don't have to go into all of them. So in a lot of these paradigms, there is some kind of cueing to attend people, to cue people to attend left or attend right, for example. And then stimuli can be presented in the attended or the unattended hemifield. So people always have some kind of warning ahead of time. And what you see is that when stimuli appear in the attended field, T1 and N1 are often enhanced. And those effects are somewhat separable, but for now, it's probably enough to say that they are enhanced when it's in the attended hemifield. Okay. Now these are going to be more peripheral than the paraphobial stimuli that we just talked about, so now they actually occur over the contralateral hemisphere. So when you attend to the left, then you'll see this maxillary over the right. And that's what this should say here. Tell us where it is. But so that would be the attentional effect. And P1 is quite sensitive to that, as is N1. And that's going to occur as early as about 100 milliseconds. Okay. Now, it's not just spatial-directed attention. Most of the early literature really focused on spatial-directed attention. But any kinds of cues that might give you an idea that you need to attend quite intensively to a stimulus may alter the amplitude and or latency of P1. So this was a study that had three different size arrays of stimuli, and you had to detect the target. The target could either be determined based on color or on orientation, like, you know, straight up or over, or a conjunction of both. And that didn't really matter quite so much. But what did matter was the array size. And you can see when the array is very large, this is a task that's going to require much, you know, more visual discrimination, P1 is larger, and its latency is a little bit earlier. Okay. The N1 also follows the P1 latency, so where P1 is earlier, N1 is also earlier. The N1 effect wasn't there. It's just the P1 effect. So increasing stimulus complexity then results in more rapid early processing. And another example of this that Taylor has done looks at stimuli that people might process preferentially. So this is a developmental study looking from age 4 on out to adulthood, and it's the P1 latency. See that faces are preferentially processed. P1 latency is earlier for faces compared to other stimuli. And in this task, they just had to look at a stimulus and say, is there an animal or not an animal in the picture? So they had non-face stimuli where all those targets were. And you see then that at all ages, the faces have a shorter latency than the other stimuli. Seems that inverted faces even have a little bit of preferential processing for the older cohorts, but not the youngest cohorts. We can say faces are special. I guess we knew that. Even as early as age 4 or 5, I would predict probably much, much earlier than that. Now, here we have data looking again at the just passive attention. They're telling people to attend right or attend left, and then a stimulus will appear in the attended or non-attended location. They don't have to do anything other than just watching the stimuli. This was a study that had data from positron emission tomography as well as from event-related potentials. So when they're attending to the left, you can see these must be sufficiently peripheral that we don't have that wrapping problem. So you can see there's a maximal activity here over the right occipital cortex. We're looking at the back of the head, there's the ears. Here, when they're attending right, we have maximal activity over the left. And if you take the difference between the two, you get this really pretty map highlighting the differences. Okay, so if you did it right minus left, the colors would just switch, right? And what's nice, is that in the PET data, you see some foci of activity that are sensible, so that when they're attending left, you get the maximal activity here over the right occipital cortex, and vice versa, and you can do the difference. So Wohldorf et al. Suggests that these data provide strong evidence that sustained visual spatial attention results in a top-down preset biasing of the early sensory input, and it does so in a retinotopically organized way. So when you attend left, it works on the right and when you tend right, it works on the left occipital cortex. Now, here's an example of then where they used the PET data to try to define a potential generator for the ERP effect and tried to see if it would fit. So this is a little bit of a prelude to the advanced topic of source localization. So they took these two locations that we see here and here and fit a hypothesized generator, a dipole, and then asked the question, could this predict the pattern of activity you see at the surface? So here's the observed data, and this would be the predicted data based on putting sources there and projecting them up to the surface. And you can see it counts for pretty much all the variance. The residual variance is 2% in that time window that's 110 to 130 milliseconds. That's an excellent, excellent fit. So that would be pretty strong evidence that the ERP data really are reflecting the same cortical activity that the PET data are. It's kind of remarkable in and of itself that the PET is a metabolic measure, the ERP is an electrical measure. You know, there's no guarantee that they're going to correspond, but it's nice when they do. Now, it worked really well because they have a component that's pretty early, so it's likely to be, you know, one generator here. They also are looking at a very small window of time. And some P3 can occur over a couple hundred milliseconds, and in that amount of time, a lot of brain can be differentially active between conditions. But for something like this, it's fairly focal. Okay. Now, just to pretend that I know something about sleep, P1 goes away during sleep, and it reemerges, however, in REM sleep. So one conclusion here is that people are attending to features of the environment when they're awake, and even in REM, to a greater degree than they are in other stages of sleep. Just pause to see if there are questions so far.
How would you know that P1 is asleep?
How would you what?
How would you know that P1 is being asleep? Like, wouldn't she have to have some different paradigm for it?
How would I know P1 is being asleep?
Yeah, no, it's present during REM.
Well, you'd have to be able to stage the sleep according to the sleep staging criteria. And then you present stimuli during these stages of sleep. And of course, this is tricky because you can't present stimuli so intense they wake the person up. Now, what I don't remember about this study is if it was auditory or visual, but P1's usually visual, so they probably have to have some kind of sensor that would just change the luminance over the eye, but not enough to wake the person up. Because their eyelids are closed, but you could imagine if a little light was flashing through the eyelid, you could still detect some changes. But I have to go back and check on that. These are difficult studies to do because you have to tweak your stimuli just right so as not to wake the person up. And even if you don't wake the person up, you can knock them out of that stage of sleep. So they don't wake up, but they're now they're out of stage 2 and they're back up to stage 1, or they're out of REM and they're in something else. But we would use the same criteria that, you know, Dick and Leisha mentioned in terms of answering the question, is somebody asleep? They'd be sleep staging criteria using the EEG. I think I'm going to make what I'll call an executive decision, that there's a big topic to start, and rather than get partway into it, I think I'll just stop. And for anybody who's a basketball fan, you probably won't argue with me. And I'll see you next week.